Okay, I think we're ready. Item number 11, the ethics training. Ms. Fulhurst.
Thank you very much for having me. I'm Stacy Fulhurst. I'm the director of the city's Ethics Commission, and I'm here today to give you a refresher training on the city's ethics laws. As you know, these laws are derived from laws that are made in Sacramento and apply to all government, high-level government officials throughout the state. We incorporate them into our local laws so we can help educate you. And one of the reasons we do this training every 2 years is not only as a refresher, we want to be sure that you know where the red flags are to call us for help, but also because the state changes the rules periodically. As a matter of fact, we're going to talk during this training, they've just changed the regulations for conflicts of interest involving real property. So we'll talk a little bit about that. So we also want to keep you abreast of those changes. Just a quick overview, as I believe most of you know, the ethics laws are focused on financial conflicts, financial disclosure and conflicts. They are not based on morality or any kind of values-based standards, and the Ethics Commission only regulates the ordinance, not any other values-based issues, as well as lobbying and campaign laws, which we're not going to talk about today. And as you're probably well aware, there may be other rules that govern the agency. Civic may have its own policies that may go above and beyond the rules we're going to talk about today. Today's the bare minimum. So one of the two fundamentals of these rules is the disclosure of personal financial interests. You are filling out a form either when you first assume office, either as a member of the board of directors or as staff within 30 days, and after that you file an annual disclosure form. The disclosure form covers the previous calendar year, and they're all filed electronically now, no paper copying, no paper filing required, thanks to our city clerk. When you're filling out your form, you should be aware that your agency has specific disclosure categories. So if the particular financial interest, whether it's an investment, a source of income, someone who's given you a gift, if they don't fall into the disclosure categories, they are not reportable. I believe the disclosure categories are your conflict of interest code, which lists the disclosures are in your backup materials. Just as a brief summary, It includes investments, sources of income and gifts from anybody that has done any of the following within the boundaries of the city: land development, construction, acquisition or sale of real property, engineering, surveying, architecture, you get it. Doesn't fall into those categories, not reportable. Something that a lot of people miss, even people who have received this training on multiple occasions, is that when you're disclosing your personal financial interests, that includes the members of your immediate family, your spouse, your domestic partner, and sometimes your dependent children. So even if you believe that your spouse or partner's business interests or clients have nothing to do with you, you still have to go through the analysis of figuring out what is reportable under the categories and the code and put that down. The idea I try and explain to people who are new to government disclosure when they and their family members are horrified at this privacy invasion, that this is the transparency that the law seeks to achieve. So the public can monitor our decisions to be sure we are not, for example, taking action that benefits the major clients of our spouse's business. That's the whole purpose of the disclosure. So with respect to investments, if you own less than 10% of a business, which is usually going to be stocks or bonds, you're going to disclose a very small, limited amount of information. And again, it has to be a stock or a bond that falls into one of your categories. Mutual funds and government bonds are exempt from disclosure. If you have a sophisticated financial portfolio where you have puts and swaps and derivatives and things like that, please contact Steve Ross in our office. He understands how all of that works much better than I do. If you own more than 10% of a company, that usually means that you or your spouse or partner owns all or part of a business entity. And in that situation, the state says that all the income that that business receives passes through to you and your family. So you have a lot more disclosure when it comes to a business that you or your family member owns 10% or more of. If you serve in a management position on a for-profit business, like you're on the board of directors of a bank, that needs to be disclosed, even if you're not paid. You need to disclose real property investments, which include leaseholds. That's considered an investment because you actually have a lease. We're going to talk about the exemption for your personal residence in a little bit. And then income, loans, and gifts received within the previous 12 months. As far as investments go, even whether it's whether it's an ownership of stock or whether you have an investment in a business, you're disclosing it if it's worth $2,000 or more at any time during the period covered by the statement. So if it's an annual form, if you own something that was worth $2,000 between January and December, you're disclosing it. As I said, if you own 10% or more of a business, there's more information to disclose, and that includes every source of income that resulted in, if your pro rata share of it is $10,000 or more. So real life example, I have to say to my overjoyed spouse at the end of every year, he owns his own business, 100%. How many clients do you have who fall within my disclosure categories who have paid you $20,000 or more gross in the last calendar year? Because my community property share under the law is 50%. That's just a presumption. And then I have to write their names down, and then Matt Potter at the Reader gets to write about them. That's what the disclosure is. Okay, no details, just their names. Same is also true if the business entity has its own investments that are reportable, including they have an investment in real property that's worth $2,000 or more. There's a disclosure page for loans, but that's really just for private party loans. Any loans made by a bank in the regular course of business, like your mortgage, your student loans, your credit card debt, none of that is reportable. Personal residence. So the general rule for real property is that you have to disclose any real property investment that's located within the city of San Diego or a 2-mile radius, except your personal residence. You get to maintain some privacy unless you meet one of these two criteria. If you are renting a bedroom in your home or you're using your entire residence as a short-term vacation rental, you'll be reporting the fair market value of the portion of your house that you're using as a rental, and then any individual source that's paid you $10,000 or more, either to rent part of the home or the whole home. Okay. Also, if you are writing off a part of your home because you're operating a business and you're taking a tax deduction, then you will also have to disclose it. So just a couple of vignettes to give some real life examples. You have a 25% partnership interest in a local engineering firm. Last year, the firm received a total of $200,000. All these thresholds are always gross, not what you net out. The firm received $200,000 in income, including income from these three clients. So your share is going to be 1/4 of each of these. So because Earth Movers is, your share is more than 10,000, and because they're going to fall into these categories of engineering, surveying, construction, development, you're going to put just the name Earth Movers in the box on the form. For ABC Construction, your quarter share is not going to reach that $10,000 threshold, but as we're going to talk about in a minute, the threshold that will trigger you to have a conflict of interest is $500, so you're always going to want to be mindful of sources of income that come into your family, either through you and your business or your spouse or partners. And then Oceanside Builders, although it's over the threshold, you would want to inquire because it's very possible that they don't do business in any of these areas within the city of San Diego. Does that all make sense? Okay. Nancy's a board member who owns a rental property that she rents for $2,000 a month. She's got a mortgage from a bank, and the same tenant lived in her property for 12 months. So during the calendar year, the tenant has paid Nancy $24,000. It's not her personal residence, so she's going to have to disclose that she owns the property. And the bank loan is going to be exempt because it's just a course of business from the bank. But income from a tenant is reportable. Okay, some people are very concerned about this privacy information. But again, that's the transparency there to be sure that someone who is paying you rent doesn't have a matter before you, and you are participating in something that will benefit them so that they can in turn pay you. Again, the tenant would have to be a reportable source in the business of any of these categories. And the same would be true even if the property has been put in your family trust. If you have if you have disclosable things that you've put into your family trust for estate planning purposes, that does not negate disclosure. You still have to disclose them. Any disclosure questions? Now that everything is online, it's much easier if you realize that you may have omitted, forgotten something. It's very easy to just go online and file an amendment, and there's no penalty for self-reporting or self-correcting any of those mistakes. Okay, the second core reason that we have these rules, disqualification and conflicts of interest. As government officials, we are not permitted to have any involvement in a government decision if there's a realistic possibility that it's going to financially impact us personally or any of our financial interests, and that includes those of our immediate family. So it's not just participating as a decision maker. It could simply be providing information, giving a staff report, even going out and just gathering statistical data is influencing the process. And so you want to be mindful of the times you need to recuse. And of course, if you have any questions about recusal, we are available at the Ethics Commission. We communicate on a regular basis with your counsel, and we'll make sure we are as efficient as possible. There are, of course, because this comes from state law, there are hundreds of pages of exceptions and regulations that govern all these rules. One of the main exceptions is what's called the public generally. If you're participating in a decision that's going to impact a significant segment of San Diego citizens in the same way, you may be allowed to participate. But again, there's a bunch of regulations we have to review, so call us and we will help you figure out if that applies. Okay, so the things that will trigger disqualification are pretty much the same things that we talked about for disclosure: an investment in a business entity, including if you own the business, a management position in a for-profit business. If you have an investment or a leasehold in real property, it can trigger disqualification. Any source of income of $500 or more within the past 12 months. That includes income that you receive or your family receives through a business if you own more than 10% of it. So if you have or your family member has clients that could have business pending before Civic, you need to keep track of a moving 12-month window to know what you can participate in, okay? Gifts, we're going to talk a little bit about gifts at the end. There's an annual gift limit of $500 that just went up, indexed for inflation. But you can also comply with that law by receiving gifts that straddle 2 years. Say someone gave you a $300 holiday gift in December, and then they gave you another $300 gift in January. You've now triggered disqualification because it's more than $500 within a 12-month period. No, you haven't violated the annual gift law, but you want to be careful that you don't trigger that as well. So the prohibition on influencing a civic matter, as we said, your financialist will financial interests will include clients of your business or your spouses or partners if you own 10% or more, but your disqualification will extend beyond just voting on the civic matter that involves that interest. You're also not permitted to discuss the client's matter with other board members before, during, or after the meeting. You can't make an appearance to the board on behalf of your client. You can't prepare documents that are submitted to the board on behalf of your client. And you can't assist other people who are going to submit documents on behalf of your client. The idea is you have some internal working knowledge of your fellow board members, and you can't have any participation that will be influencing their decisions. So in addition to what I've just covered, there are other agencies and staff prohibitions. So you can't talk to the agency staff on behalf of a client if that matter could ultimately come before the board. If you have a client whose project is going to be processed by another city board or commission before it gets to Civic, you may not discuss that project with the other board or its staff. and that goes all the way down to a community planning group. If that project could be appealed and could come before Civic, you cannot influence the process starting at the very beginning all the way through on behalf of your client. However, here's what you can do. Any other member of your firm or agency or staff of your company may make all of those presentations and have all of those contacts we talked about, provided that you do not assist them in any way. Also, if you have clients who have projects that are never going to come before Civic, you may assist them with processing their approvals through other boards and agencies at the city. And then finally, once Civic has made a final decision, as long as there's no possibility of it coming back, you may assist them going forward, whether they have to go to Coastal Commission or City Council or what have you. Finally, there is an exception for technical documents. If you are preparing documents that are purely technical in nature, and there are a whole bunch of advisory opinions about what that means, but if you're preparing documents that are purely technical, you may submit them on behalf of your client. And also, if you are representing your own personal interests, you may certainly speak as any member of the public would about your personal interests, your neighborhood, et cetera. Any questions? We've got a couple of examples. Okay. Which of the following activities may you lawfully engage in on behalf of a client who's got a matter that is going to be coming before the Civic Board of Directors? Putting together a report that's going to be part of the backup with your signature, obviously not. Even editing a report that someone else in your office has put together, even if it doesn't mention your name, you're still prohibited from being involved in that process. Helping the client with some verbal hints, even on their presentation, even if you're not going to be standing up with them, still prohibited. Architectural plans are considered purely technical, and you may go ahead and submit those. Okay, and of course, any other member of your firm may do all of these things without your involvement. Civic is asked to approve the construction of a new homeless shelter downtown. One of the board members owns a condominium that's located a few blocks away from the proposed site where they're going to put the shelter. He doesn't think the shelter is going to impact him any differently from anybody else downtown, so he goes ahead and participates in the decision. So the first response to that is that's probably a very big mistake. By way of greater explanation, you're probably all familiar with the state has always had what they call the 500-foot rule. Your staff was probably always showing you what a 500-foot radius from a project is. The state has been concerned over the years that people rely too heavily on that number without further analysis of the nature of the project and how it will impact things. In other words, if you're lighting a bus bench, it's not going to impact anything and it doesn't matter. On the other hand, if you are building a new sports stadium, you could be thousands of feet away and it could still impact you. So, but the state has recently modified the 500-foot rule so that we say they've now created a donut. They've got a 500-foot rule and a 1,000-foot rule and beyond. And this is the basic rule. If it is a certain level of project, obviously something that is going to come before your board is going to be of this level, if you are within 500 feet, there's a presumption that you have a conflict of interest. There are ways that you can rebut that, and we can help you go through that analysis, as can your counsel. Between the 500 and 1,000, there are a whole series of analysis that you have to go through to determine. In other words, now you're in a maybe zone. Beyond 1,000 feet, and they did this because people said, we want a line. We don't want to just have this never-ending radius. So they said, okay, we'll give you 1,000 feet. If you're outside of 1,000 feet, there's a presumption that you may participate. But again, you have to consider the magnitude of the project. There was, and by way of example, there was a lot of publicity last year about a development in East County that was before the County Board of Supervisors. One of the supervisors owned property that was miles away from where a development was going to go. But the FPPC said, because approving the development was going to change the zoning potential for the entire backcountry by putting in infrastructure and allowing all kinds of other things. It was a significant possibility it was going to impact property owned miles away. So it's just an example of you don't ever want to assume that, you know, you're 1,005 feet away, you're good to go. It all depends on the magnitude of the project. Civic is reviewing an application by, and forgive me for my ignorance about land use matters, is reviewing an application from a builder to develop a new high-rise condo project downtown. Your spouse is an attorney who works in a law firm, and the firm received $50,000 from this builder in the past 12 months for work completely unrelated to the project. Maybe it was for helping with an employment matter. But your spouse is one of 10 partners in the law firm, so she owns 10% of the firm, but she didn't even work on this matter for the builder. You are not permitted to participate in this decision. The idea is that as a 10% owner of the business, the income, even though it was unrelated to the project before you, has passed through the business to your family, and your spouse's share as one of 10 partners is $5,000. That means your share is more than $500, and you're triggering disqualification. And again, if I didn't say this at the beginning, all of these rules are about the appearance of things, not because you would ever truly be influenced in this scenario. I'm sure you would all feel that you could be perfectly fair and reasonable given this scenario, but it's the appearance that we want to assure the public that we're not being influenced by our sources of income, and that's why we recuse ourselves. If the decision involved a development agreement, we are now triggering a second rule, which is called Government Code Section 1090. It has to do with contracts. And I understand that Civic does not ever or rarely approve any contracts, but even making a recommendation to the City Council concerning a development agreement is the early stages of making a contract. So you want to be really careful. Under the state law, if this rule is violated, the contract gets voided. So you can imagine a horrible situation where you've approved a low-income housing project and this law was inadvertently violated and the developer has to give all the money back. It's in the state does void these things all the time. So if you're working on anything that could lead to a contract, be sure and put your hand up immediately. I know you all go to Mr. Haggerty, which is great, and we work with him closely whenever any of these issues come up. In addition, because this rule is much more onerous than your basic rank and file decisions, if you're a member of a legislative body like this board, if any one of you has a financial interest in a contract, it is very possible that the whole board cannot make the contract. In other words, the one board member's recusal may not be enough. Again, no surprise, this is like the Full Employment Act for attorneys. There's a whole host of exemptions that may allow them to recuse, et cetera. But if you are working on a contract, you want to check and be absolutely certain that there's nothing that could lead to a violation. It doesn't make any difference if, as I said, if you're just involved in a recommendation or something that's leading to a contract, it's still part of the flow. Even if the contract is an excellent deal for the city, it doesn't matter. One of the things about this provision that probably would never come up here, but you should be aware of, is it applies to the moment that you're working on a decision and indefinitely into the future. So say that this agency wanted to recommend to the city that they set up a new mechanism for funding low-income housing. And that ends up resulting in a series of contracts where the city gives grants to people for that. You may not roll off this board and then become one of those people who gets one of those contracts because you helped create that program. Does that make sense? So just keep that in mind as you go forward. And as I said, there are a whole host of exemptions for and qualifiers that we can help you work through with Mr. Haggerty if you have any problems. So by way of an example, we have that the board recommends that the council hire a consultant to advise the council on specific issues on tideland development. They say there's a project coming down the pike and we think you're going to need an expert. The city council says, okay, we think that's a great idea. We're going to hire, let's hire someone. And one of the board members here says, actually, I happen to have that expertise. You should hire my firm. And they, well, that's probably a finance, that's probably a conflict of interest. Well, I'll offer to do it for free. We have an opinion from the Attorney General's office that says, even if you're working for free, if it's going to enhance the value of your business, you have a financial interest. In other words, I did this work for the city. Okay, so just keep that in mind. Whenever there's a contract involved, just be very careful. By way of another example, contracts can go beyond just the development agreements and land use things that you're approving. All of the employment arrangements here are considered employment contracts, even people who are at will. So mostly for the staff in the room, but here's an example of an assistant VP with the agency participates in a decision to promote someone. And the person gets promoted and now the lower job is vacant and the VP's spouse would like to apply for that job. If you, this sounds nice and rosy because it's a promotion, but if Susan had fired someone and then her spouse wanted the job, you can't create a job that you fill. Probably a lot of you, well, maybe actually a lot of the people in this room will remember. We used to have a city manager form of government. And when the voters approved strong mayor, there was someone who worked for the city manager who understood that she had a few more months of work and she would be out of a job. So she identified the department director in the city that whose job duties were best matched to her qualifications, and she fired that person and put herself and had the city manager put herself in that job. So that's just an example. It seems like no one would ever do these things, but that's what you can't do. Yes. Can you give me? Yes, no, what I was saying was if you wanted to offer to contract with the city for your firm to do services on a particular project, this itself is not part of that scenario because there's, it's not, you didn't make a recommendation for an to create an existing contract. Does that make sense?
Sure.
Okay. Exactly, exactly. You'd, yeah. Anything else? This one only applies to the compensated folks in the room. You can't be paid by the agency to use, be paid by a private sector interest while you're using the agency's time or equipment. Shockingly, there are government officials who have used their city resources to run eBay businesses and things like that. And you can't trade on your title for compensation from the private sector. Like, you know, I'm the VP at Civic and therefore you should give me this consulting gig. The president of Civic is asked by a political committee to support an upcoming ballot measure. Maybe it's going to provide some funding for low-income housing, and he thinks that's a great idea. So he says, I definitely will support the measure, and they offer to pay him $5,000 if they can publish his statement of support in their campaign literature. That's trading on your title, and you can't financially benefit from that. Makes sense. Okay, misuse of position. What's that expression? No good deed goes unpunished. Your volunteer service to the city does not come with any financial benefits. So you don't get to use your position to benefit yourself financially either inside or outside the city by suggesting to someone, hey, you know who I am, I should get this for free. Confidential information. If you have any question about information that you have that you've obtained during your work with Civic, whether it's confidential, please check with us, but you may not ever disclose confidential information, even if you don't financially benefit. And because we are perpetually in campaign season, it seems, city officials may not use city resources to support a campaign for elective city office. So again, this is one of the benefits of doing this for so many years. These are all real life examples. Volunteer board member contacts the office of city council member and says, look, I've been volunteering on the civic board for years now. I've given a lot of my time volunteering to the city. Doesn't seem like too much to ask for you to prioritize my residential street for undergrounding of utility lines. We had someone do this, went to the bottom of the pile in the council office and still paid a penalty. You just don't get the benefit of things, the financial benefits because of who you are, paid or unpaid in the city. Political activity, as government officials, we cannot offer to get someone an appointment to a paid or unpaid position in exchange for political favors or personal favors. You know, hey, if you raise some money for my mayoral campaign, I'll be sure you get appointed to the Planning Commission. That's what you can't do. And we may not knowingly ask people we know who work for the city, which includes civic, to make a campaign contribution to a city candidate. Anybody can make a contribution of their own volition. We just don't want them to feel obligated. We tell all of the candidates to scrub their email lists because, well, if they buy a mailing list, they don't know if Stacy Fullhorst is on that mailing list. But if they have an email list that says sfullhorst@sandiego.gov, they should know that I'm a government employee, and so they should scrub it. If anybody in this room gets an email at their civic domain name, be sure and let the person know that they need to scrub their list better to remove the agency. We give them all the agency domains as well, but things get missed in the heat of a campaign all the time. Yes? No? Yep. Exactly. Exactly. You don't want to suggest that you should be treated any differently because you're on the board. Yes. And it has to be about a decision. You have to be trying to influence them in a way that benefits you financially. Like in my example, that was going to enhance the value of your home. If you're just calling your council member and saying, someone's going to get killed in the street by my house because everybody's racing and you really ought to send out someone to look at a stop sign, it's probably a little different. Probably not going to financially benefit you. Okay. Any other questions? Political activity, let's say you've decided that you want to support one of the candidates for mayor. Actually, this one says city council, doesn't it? City council, so you're going to walk out through the neighborhood on weekends and you're going to knock on doors telling people why they should vote for your friend. As you're knocking on doors, someone opens a door and you recognize someone who works in a council office. You tell them why they should vote for your friend. You ask them if they want to volunteer at the campaign headquarters, make some calls. You ask them if you can put a yard sign in their yard. That's all fine. Then you give them a remittance envelope so they can send in the money. That's what you don't want to do. Okay? Don't want to make them feel obligated. So they obviously know that they can give money however they want, whenever they want. Just a final few things about gifts. I know that most people who go through this training the first time sort of glaze over. They think nobody gives anybody in the government anything. But again, the state has adopted all of these rules because there are things that may personally benefit you, even though you feel that they were something you had to do as part of your work. For example, the staff goes to a downtown community event on a Thursday evening as part of their jobs, and they get a rubber chicken dinner. Well, they'd much rather be home, but the state says they just got a benefit because they got a chicken dinner. So we want to just be sure you know the lay of the land, although in the recent years, there have been some really good exceptions adopted for personal relationships. So it used to be that you look on your disclosure categories. If your college roommate happened to be a local engineer and they bought you something, you would have to make, it would be in your disclosure categories. Now there are exemptions for personal relationships. So just a quick overview. Any donor, yes ma'am, no. Yes, if the client falls into one of these categories. Then that we'd have to see if the chamber falls into any of these categories. There is an exception if it is a 501c3 fundraiser and the host invites you. The chamber is not a C3, so it wouldn't fall into that. Again, it's like if a grand opening is a developer is doing a grand opening for a project, they fall into your disclosure categories. You will have to ask them what the per person cost is of hosting that event, and we give you some more details if you go. It's the per person cost of catering, any feature entertainment at the event, and any kind of swag that they give you. So by way, and that rule has actually been changed over time. For those of you and maybe some of the staff who remember, we had a grand opening of the Mark condominiums a few years back. And at the time, it was the total per person cost of the event, which ended up to be about $800. Now it's been way pared down to just catering, feature entertainment, et cetera. Okay. Yes, sir.
Employee. So what is what? And so.
Right. So an interesting point. So there's no the gift is still a gift given to you if it's given in a different context. However, there are a whole host of rules about if you are speaking, whether you're performing a ceremonial role, whether it's income because you're providing a service instead. So you would want to work out those details with Steve Ross in my office. Okay. Yep. Devil's in the details. Okay, I'll go through a couple things, but please keep the questions coming. So if somebody gives you something that falls into one, and the source falls into one of your disclosure categories, if they give you stuff, gifts, that add up to $50 or more in a calendar year, you have to itemize them on your form. So if they take you to lunch 5 times, you may have to itemize those. If it's a group gift, everybody pitched in to get a birthday gift, it doesn't matter, you don't have to disclose that as long as each person didn't contribute $50 or more. Everybody put in 10 bucks, it's a nothing. The gift limit went up to $500 in a calendar year. We talked about gifts overlapping 2 years. Any discount or a rebate that's offered to you that's not given to all city employees or the general public is also a gift. So by way of example, I had someone recently who was working on some energy plan, and they were on a task force, and they got to be friendly with another member of the task force who worked for Sempra. And he was telling her that he was remodeling his kitchen, and she said, you know what, we've got an employee program for 20% discount on appliances, let me get you signed up. He called and said, is that a gift? We said, yeah, it is. You just have to report it, and you can accept up to $500. It was $470 at the time, and put it on your form. It's not offered to everybody. If you don't like a gift that someone gives you, it doesn't matter. You still have to report it. You'd be surprised how much this comes up with elected officials. Unless it's a ticket to a one-time event, someone gives you 2 tickets to the opera and you don't like the opera and you don't use it, it's nothing. If a local builder gives you 2 tickets to an opera and you give them to somebody else, you're still reporting it because you decided who would use them. If you get a gift and you don't want the gift, you don't want to have to report it, it's over the limit, there's several things you can do. And by the way, there is nothing nefarious with reporting a gift. We get people who call us in a panic that they're going to have to put down that they went to the chamber dinner and it was $120. There is nothing wrong with that. That's just disclosure and transparency. But if you don't want it, whatever, within 30 days, you can give it back. You can pay for all or part of it. Somebody gives you 2 tickets to the All-Star game and you want to go, but it's $700. You can just pay it down to $500. Or you can give it to a 501c3. Sometimes you can give it to the city if it's like city memorabilia. I think we have some Hard Rock guitar somewhere in the mayor's floor, you can talk to Liz Maland in the clerk's office, and she'll help you do that. Some gifts have weird rules. One that we want you to know about are wedding gifts. They're not subject to the limit, but you do have to report them. Okay, now here come all the exceptions, which should basically cover just about everything outside of your service at Citi. Anybody from your entire extended family can give you gifts, and it's nothing. The state recently added first cousins once removed and former spouses. So that gives you an idea of how broad it is. Free or discounted admission to a local seminar. That presumes that it's reasonably related to your work here. It's not a golf seminar. The public benefits because we don't have to use taxpayer money. You go, someone invites you over to their home. You don't have to ask them how much it costs to entertain you. And one of my favorites, this is, it comes straight out of the statute. Gifts received in the course of a bona fide dating relationship are not reportable. So even if your significant other is in land development, you can receive gifts from them and they're not reportable. We do not, and this is no joke, we don't give advice on whether you qualify for a bona fide dating relationship. There are a lot of people who are in a panic and they think that they have to meet some definition. If you conclude that you're in a dating relationship, that's good enough for us. Okay, and the two big personal relationship exemptions. The first one is trading gifts. If you have an ongoing social relationship with someone, you've known them for a while and they're your friend, you can trade things during the year. I'll pay for movie tickets, you pay for happy hour, and you haven't received anything as long as they basically even out by the end of the year. And then the rule that the state calls the BFF rule. If you have a long-term personal friend, and it's not defined, and the friend has not engaged in any business in front of Civic, and it's not foreseeable that they will within the next 12 months, they can give you gifts. You don't have to reciprocate, and you don't have to report them. Neither one of these gifts can be applied if your friend is a registered lobbyist with the city. If you have any question about whether they're registered, we can help you figure that out on the clerk's website.
Stacey, it might be a good time just to remind everyone, all the staff, that we still have a policy on gifts that basically says no gifts. So all these rules are important because it factors into whether what you're getting is a gift or not. But if it is a gift and it's above the $50, our policy currently says you can't accept it at all.
Okay.
Right. That's so if it's a gift, and a gift is 50 right. or over. So, yeah, so yeah. That's right. If it, yeah, exactly. But I mean, anything that falls with any of these rules, talk to us about it.
Because so if someone gets invited to, like we were saying, to the chamber event, they have to pay. If it comes from a source,
right? That's
if it's
right.
reportable,
and it's the exceptions on free seminars or discounted seminars are important because that's something we do take advantage
okay.
of. So
all the exceptions apply to
exactly,
right.
yeah.
Right.
So
okay.
So there are special rules. I don't know if you're going to cover them on gifts to the entity, but there are special rules on that. We need to talk about those things. But, I mean, the basic idea should be, I mean, I get someone sends me a bottle of champagne every year and I send it back because the civic rule says I can't accept that. So that's just how it is.
I'll jump in on the gift basket. We usually don't even have to get as far as the sophistication of gifts to the agency, which requires a form. We usually say, well, how many employees do you have? And is it equate to more than $50 per each person? Even a nice gift basket is usually not 50 bucks times every employee here. So in our universe, including the civic policy, it would not be a gift if, you know, the gift basket costs $300. It's not going to be worth 50 bucks per person. If your name is on it, that's a different deal. If your name is on it, it's your gift. Yes, sir. Sure. So gifts from lobbyists are Well, there's two different things here. Let me go. The lobbying laws, which do not apply to you as city officials, they just apply to registered lobbyists, say that they may not give a government official gifts worth more than $10 in a calendar month. But as the slide earlier was about, if you want to claim that you have a long-term friend who's a lobbyist, who a long-term friend, and you wanted it to be exempt because of your long-term friendship, you can't do that if they're a lobbyist. And then, of course, you really can't accept. You can accept it. They'll just be in trouble if it's more than 10 bucks. We try really hard not to make people feel that they have to know the rules of the other laws for other people. Okay, if you do get a gift and you're trying to figure out what the value is, either for reporting or for whether it complies with the civic policy, if it's a ticketed event, meaning anybody can buy a ticket and it's the value that's printed on the ticket, even if you didn't like it, even if you left early, even if the food was lousy, everything else is going to be pretty much the fair market value. And if you imagine these rules in the 70s before there was the internet and Google, but now you can figure out what the fair market value is by looking at something comparable if you need to online. If it's something unusual and you're having a hard time, you can check with us and we'll help you. But again, you want to find out what the value is before you accept or use a gift. We covered what the state calls invitation-only events, like the opening for the mark. It's only a select group of people are invited. The value is now what's underlined here. And then we also covered the rule, if you're invited to a charitable fundraiser for a 501c3 and the host invites you, Father Joe's Villages is hosting a fundraiser and they invite you to go. You've been invited by the host. It's a C3 fundraiser. You and a guest may go and it's not a gift. And the same is true for a political fundraiser. If a political party is hosting a fundraiser and they invite you to go, again, you can go and it's not a gift. You're probably going to get hit up to make a contribution. Okay, this is a relatively new rule, and we think it makes some sense. The rule about your immediate family members receiving a gift used to be that if your spouse or domestic partner got a gift and you used it, you had to report it. And they've changed that now. It doesn't matter if you use it. If your family member gets a gift, the only time you have to disclose it, or subject to the civic policy, is if one of these checked items is true. There's no working or social relationship between the donor and your family member. So if you think about that, that means someone gives my spouse a gift who doesn't work with them or socialize with them. It means he doesn't know them. The reason that we have that rule, shockingly, there have been government officials in California who have said, well, I can't accept a gift, so just give it to my spouse. That's why we have that. Even if your spouse does know the person, if the second bullet is true, it's your gift. If there's evidence that suggests that they may want to influence you, in other words, a local attorney is an old friend of my husband's, buys him a round of golf, but he's also representing someone who has a matter pending before the Ethics Commission. Because they could be trying to influence me by doing something nice for my family, it's still my gift. Okay? So either one of those. And by the way, somebody must have given something to somebody's college kid, because now, for purposes of gifts, your family includes your full or part-time student children who are between 18 and 23. The odds of your child in college getting something from someone who has business pending before you seems pretty slim, but I mention it so you know. Almost done, I promise. Honoraria is very severely restricted under state laws. Anybody offering to pay you to give a speech, write an article, or attend an event. If anybody asks you, please check with us before you accept it. And that includes directing the payment. I can't accept that, but I'll tell you who to give it to. You can't do that either. Travel is one of those rules that has 50 regulations because it is so fraught with potential problems in terms of appearance. You may have a very legitimate reason for needing to go to Hawaii or China or Rome, but the rules are there so that we're the whole host of rules to be sure that you've checked all the boxes and you're kosher. So anytime you get offered travel payments, whether it's transportation, lodging, or meals while you're there, please check with us so we can research it. But the standard rules are, if a government's paying, it's not a gift, any government agency. If a 501c3 is paying, and there's a legislative or governmental purpose for your travel, it's not subject to the limit, but you have to disclose it, and it may subject you to conflicts. But here's how that really works. The people who want government officials throughout California to go to their events set up a foundation, a 501c3. And then they invite the government officials through that foundation that pays for it. Obviously, there's going to be a governmental purpose related to civics work that you go. That foundation will never have business before you, so you're not going to have a conflict. But it's set up to work within the system. But again, you just want to be sure that that is the case. As you may recall, we had a mayor who said that a 501c3 paid for him to travel, and it turned out they were not a 501c3. Okay, so you want to be sure and check with us in advance. Anybody else paying for your travel is generally going to be treated as a gift, but as I said, I can't impress upon you enough how complicated these rules are. It depends if it's inside California, outside California. Are you giving a speech? Does it count as income? All kinds of things like that. So just check with us before you go. Okay, you're invited to go to a big invitation-only party that the Padres are hosting after they win the World Series. You're told that the cost of food and beverage at the event, the catering bill, is $100 a person. So you go to the event, but you only stay for a few minutes, and you don't eat or drink anything. So there is a rule, first off, called the drop-in rule. It's primarily designed for elected officials who go to the reception or the cocktail hour. They don't stay for the main event. They have to shake a few hands and they leave. If, as long as you are not present for the main meal or the main entertainment, you have not received a gift. Even if you ate some appetizers and drank some beer before you left. Okay? But the point is, you can't be present. Remember that Mark party we were just talking about? We had a council staffer who took three friends. They stayed for the entire time. But he misunderstood the rule, so he said you can't eat or drink anything to his friends. Then he found out that he had received a gift of $800 per person times four. Very, very painful, and they hadn't even enjoyed it. I was not very popular with his friends that week. So you want to be sure you know what the drop-in rule means. On the other hand, if you decide this is a great party and you want to stay for the entire event, the purpose of this scenario is it's in your own best interest to be skeptical if you're receiving information that just seems like it can't be true. Back to the Mark party, everybody passed around some information through word of mouth that maybe the developer misunderstood and said it was $100. Okay, the invitation was an engraved lucite plaque that probably cost $75. There were Cirque du Soleil people trapezing off the side of the building. This is there's no way the Padres are hosting a party after they win the World Series that's $100 a person. A lot of times, if you get invited to these events, they don't want to tell you. We have a form on our website that you can email to them that says, the Ethics Commission is making you tell me how much this event costs. And again, it's not the total event anymore. It's just the catering. But even the catering bill is going to be more than $100 a person at a party like this. And what if you brought your spouse with you? Just a reminder that it's times two because you brought someone, a guest with you. A local consulting firm is hosting a seminar regarding homeless issues in San Diego, and they offer to comp you. Again, the registration is not a gift because we're not using public taxpayer money to pay. But if they give you lunch at the seminar, the state says that that is still a benefit because you're getting the food. So hopefully that gift is under $50, that lunch, so it complies with your policy. And you can go and get the free free conference registration and not worry about your gift rules. If the seminar's in Hawaii and they offer to pay your airfare and your hotel, again, you want to check with us so we can find out if you can go. There are a lot of times that we have people in the city, especially with people who have expertise in a particular area. They get paid to travel around the world because they have so much expertise and they provide a service by speaking at a particular event. A lot of times that's considered income, and they just report that as a source of income. Like I said, don't assume that it's a no. We just want to be sure we walk you through so that you are absolutely on the right side before you go on the trip. Two quick things before I'm done that have to do with when you leave the agency. The first one applies to volunteers and paid staff. If you are seeking future employment from someone, either you want to go work for them or you want to add them as a client, you may not participate in any civic decisions that involve their interests. Okay, the idea is the public doesn't want you to maybe be making decisions that are favoring someone because you're hoping you can get some work from them. That doesn't mean that they've actually offered you a job. A prospective employer or client can be someone where you've just discussed the possibility, you've put in an application or a bid, that it triggers your need to recuse, okay? It does not apply if you are looking to go work for another public agency. So John is a member of the Civic Board. He's also a partner in a local architectural firm. A local developer has asked the board to pay for some public improvements associated with the condo project downtown. And one day, John runs into the developer walking downtown, and the builder says, by the way, I'm accepting some bids right now for to design a small commercial building in Pacific Beach. And now that I've run into you, your firm should submit a bid for this. John says, I'm definitely interested. What's the deadline for submittal? And then he goes and participates in the civic decision about the developer's application. This is just an example of John's crossed the line and he needs to recuse himself now because he could be adding this builder as a client of his firm. Does it make sense? Post-employment. When you leave Civic, if as volunteers, you have no post-employment restrictions whatsoever, but for the paid staff in the room, you do have a one-year cooling off period. It does not prohibit you. I feel like I should turn around. It does not prohibit you from going to work for anybody. I tell everybody that Amy Fawcett and Chris Michelle are my poster children for post-employment lobbying success. You will have value to lots of people, and you can work within the lobbying restrictions for the first year while you're gone. It's definitely workable. If you're thinking of leaving the agency, talk to us and we'll walk you through details. A lot of this just doesn't really resonate until you're thinking of leaving, but you have a one-year cooling off period where you can't work for a private company and lobby the city. You also can't help your new private employer behind the scenes if it's a project you worked on while you were at Civic. In other words, you started preliminary work, you worked on some design review, now they're coming back for further approvals. You can't switch sides and go help them inside on the private sector side. Any questions about that, you can let us know. As I said, they don't apply to people who didn't receive compensation. They also, if you leave Civic and go work for another public agency, they also won't apply to you. And finally, if you're working on something that's ministerial in nature, they're not going to apply. But again, if you're thinking of leaving the agency, just call us. That's when it'll make the most sense to you. That is it with respect to a few caveats about providing advice. The whole purpose of making you go through this every 2 years, again, is not just a refresher, but a reminder. Please, please, please check with us for advice. We have people who take a break from meetings and call us and say, the next item on the agenda, I don't know what to do. We'll do the best we can. It's better that you call us than that you don't. We can only help you with something you're contemplating doing in the future. So if you've already done it, it's too late for us to give you any help. So please call us in advance. If we give you a formal written opinion, it's because we think it's going to help a lot of people. So we post it on our website. But formal or informal, we will always stand behind the advice we give you as long as you've asked for it in good faith and given us accurate set of facts to follow. Steve Ross and I never take the same day off. He is the better point of contact. He's much more knowledgeable than I am, but we'll never leave you hanging. If you have a question, we will always get back to you in 24 hours, so please don't hesitate to check with us. Thank you for having me. Any final questions? See you in two years.
I'd just like to thank Stacy, because honestly, every time you guys have a question, I often reach out to her, and she is incredibly responsive and really appreciate that.
Thanks so much.
We have some recent examples of that, but I really do appreciate your work. Thanks.
It really is our first priority. A lot of these rules are not intuitive, even if you're a well-meaning person, and we just want to make sure you don't make a mistake. Thanks.
Thank you. Sure. 5-minute break.